Well, what burns out air conditioning compressors is loss of charge. So it's these slow leaks. I mean, this is turning into a sales pitch for a Micron vacuum gauge. This is really what it comes down to. But your slow leaks that may take 8 months to a year to leak out enough charge. So let's say you have a system that takes 5 pounds, the compressor's dead, you weigh your charge when you reclaim the refrigerant, and it's 3 pounds. Well, that tells you there's a problem.
At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1, with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal. The professional's choice.
What's up, guys? Welcome back. So we got Jamie Kitchen back on the podcast. And again, he's here to blow our minds. Remember like the superheat episode? Remember the subcooling episode? Those are very popular episodes with Jamie. And if you haven't heard them, go back and find them because you'll enjoy those as well. But we're going to talk like refrigeration side troubleshooting on this episode. And Jamie deep dives. That's just what he does. He just deep dives and goes at it. So pay close attention because he moves quickly. This is the HVAC Know It All podcast. I'm your host, Gary McCready. This podcast is sponsored by Master. And if you guys are into rapid locking system, they also stock at their main distribution warehouse. So if you want to place an order through Master for rapid locking system, you're more than welcome to do so. Get your order in and they can bring it into the branch of your choice. Check out master.ca. This podcast is sponsored by Cintas. They are your leader for blue-collar uniforms. They got rental programs. They have all different kinds of stuff. Carhartt. They got winter gear, summer gear, spring gear. If you're looking to outfit your team with the right gear for the blue-collar work, check out cintas.com/HVAC know-it-all.
Welcome to the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. Recorded from a basement somewhere in Toronto, Canada. Your host and HVAC tech, Gary McCready, will take you on a deep dive into the industry, discussing all things HVAC. From storytelling to technical discussion. Enjoy the show.
All right, well, that was fun this morning. Everybody that's seen the video earlier of Jamie and I at the back of my van. It was actually a good sort of imagery because the snow was falling and just gives an indication to all the techs down south, what we got to go through up here and working in this part of the world.
Yeah, I can get used to the heat. It's hard for me to get used to the cold. It really is.
Yeah,
I'll be the first.
Not a fan of the cold at all. I actually spent a week down in Florida, as I was telling you earlier, and one of the techs was telling a story. He was on a strip mall working on one unit, and I guess each individual store in that strip mall has their own contractor. So he said there was a guy, the guy came up onto the roof. He said it was sweltering hot. When it's cold, you can always put clothes on, but you can only take so much off. But he said this guy, he looked over at him and he was in his boxers and his work boots, and that's all he was wearing.
Oof.
In Florida. So that's kind of funny. Anyway,
you want to make sure you had a pretty good base tan, man. I just burst into flame if I tried to do that.
Yeah. But you got to be brave to work in your boxers. Anyway, we're going to talk about refrigeration troubleshooting. We've done very popular podcasts in the past. I would say that two of the most popular ones over the last couple of years is Superheat and Subcooling. And
those are critical in troubleshooting.
They are. So, I mean, let's talk about the basic form refrigeration, the refrigeration cycle. Just take a couple minutes. We'll go through that because there's technicians, believe it or not, Jamie, you probably believe me because you've come across them that have been in the trade for 20 years and they're installing, banging in equipment, but they don't even really understand the refrigeration cycle. They know that there's an evaporator and a condenser, but they don't know how it all intertwines and works with each other. So let's start there quickly.
Okay. Well, an installer, to be honest with you, a lot of times large contractors, I noticed this in the States too, they'll separate their installers from their service teams. In general, you can migrate from your install to your service, but that's where that sudden increase in theory, so to speak, comes in handy. And the reason you want to understand the refrigeration cycle is the task of troubleshooting on the refrigeration side, not so much on the electrical side, that's different, is what is the system doing now? How is it behaving compared to what it would be doing if it was working the way it's supposed to? And so you mentioned superheat and subcooling. These are two things that come into play there. Let's just throw an easy peasy one out there. You're low on charge, right? You got a low evaporator temperature, saturation temperature. That can be caused by a couple of different things. But you have high superheat in your evaporator. Now, that doesn't indicate a low refrigerant charge in your system. It just indicates that you don't have enough refrigerant in your evaporator. All superheat is an indication of how much refrigerant you have compared to how much load there is in the evaporator. So if you run out of liquid sooner because you don't have enough refrigerant in there, you're going to have more time to superheat. So that's a very basic thing. The alternative way that, let's say you have a low evaporating temperature and your superheat is like almost nothing. Well, that tells you it's not a refrigerant charge. You just don't have any airflow on your evaporator, right? You got, so that's two different ways of looking at it. Whereas a normal evaporator, if it's running, let's say you got in a cooler 20, 22 degrees of evaporator temperature, you know, on a steady state load, you might have 9 degrees of superheat. If you've got a load on there, humidity, you might have 11 or 12. But in refrigeration, most valves fully stroke open in about 5 to 6 degrees of superheat from where they start opening. And I know that may take a little bit of backtracking to explain, but if you have really, really, really high superheat, like 25, 30 degrees, then that's not the way it's supposed to be. There's no type of situation that explains that in normal operation. You either have an undersized valve, you don't have enough refrigeration, you've got a blockage in your liquid line, you know, who knows?
Or what about if you just have some massive amounts of load because the thing was off for 2 days because you're doing a repair and now you're starting it up from scratch and you have a massive load. You could also see it there too, right?
Yeah. Your indication then would be your evaporator temperature would be high. Mm-hmm. So one of the things about TXVs that's magical about them compared to everything else is that they can open up a lot more than what they're rated for. So we have this thing called nominal capacity. And nominal capacity is what you rate a component at based on a specific set of conditions. And those conditions are the same for everybody when they're doing it. And that way it allows us to compare apples to apples. Otherwise, you could make a component give you any capacity you want if you fooled around with the parameters. So if the TXV opens up and it's throttled wide open, it's giving you about 30 or 40% more capacity than what it's actually rated for. So if it's a nominal one-ton valve, it's giving you about 1.3, 1.4 tons. That's what you're going to see in a maximum opened up TXV under very, very high load. If it's sized correctly, your evaporator temperature, let's say you normally see 22, 23 degrees on your evaporator temperature. You might see 28, 29 degrees, maybe even 30. Because what's happening is the TXV is dumping so much refrigerant in your evaporator, the only way for that fixed speed compressor to pump it is for the evaporator temperature to go up. So the TXV throttles open, your evaporator saturation temperature and pressure goes up, and your superheat increases. If it's above, in most coolers or freezers, if it's above 15, 16, maybe 18 degrees at the evaporator outlet, that means your load drastically exceeds what your TXV can open up and give you. So, that things to do then is to say, okay, what is my component capacity? Does it match the load on this? Or did I put so much load in here, it's just beyond what this is normally capable of doing?
Yeah, keep in mind, it's happened to me before. I just want to throw an example in for the audience here. It's happened to me before where I'm working in a pharma walk-in, right? Mm-hmm. And this one freezer I used to work on, all they had in it was ice packs. And the ice packs were for when they ship, they throw an ice pack in a box to keep the product cool, right? And then it goes into a refrigerated truck.
Are these like a plastic glycol pack or something?
They're actually blue ice packs. I don't know if it was water inside. I don't know what was inside them, but they were ice packs. So what they would do is they'd bring these ice packs in. They would be sitting on a warehouse floor, and then they would load it up into the freezer, and I'd get a call that the freezer was too warm. And I'd show up, and luckily for me that when they loaded it up, they would actually put the time and the date when they loaded it into the thing. So every time I got there, I would go in and I would look at the little time and date that they've stamped or put onto that skid. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, wait a minute, you just loaded these 3 hours ago. And when I touch them, they're at like room temperature still. I mean, no wonder your temperature shot up. Mm-hmm. So they were overloading. They were putting too many skids of these ice packs in at a time. Mm-hmm. It's like taking, and I used the example. I said, guys, think about it this way. I said, let's take an empty refrigerator. Let's mm-hmm. say it's down to temperature, and then you take beer.
A couple of cases of beer.
Or
out of the trunk of your car at 90 degrees.
Out of the trunk of your car and throw it in that refrigerator. What do you think is going to happen to the temperature of the box? Yeah. It's going to go way up.
Yep.
I said, when you do this, it's better to load them one skid at a time, not three or four at a time. And what they started to do, which was their idea, and I'm like, you guys are good on you for thinking of this. They would put the skids into a larger cooler that didn't have a lot of load in it. So they put it in the cooler first, bring it down to
that's actually 4 or 5 degrees. Yeah, actually. Yeah.
And then they put it into the freezer afterwards. Yeah. So the hit wasn't as much. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt, but I wanted
to. No, you make a couple of really good points there going back to your fridge. Now, Gary and I are fortunate or unfortunate in having gone through a program at Humber College. We had to sit through, at least I did, what was called in refrigeration, a Hussmann load estimating program. And one of the key things in that was pretty straightforward. You get a certain amount of product tonnage, you get a certain amount of heat load, whether you're putting berries, hams, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter, fresh product.
I remember doing these manually.
Manually, these on, that's right. Yeah, and you had manually, to go through and do all manually. Your heat transfer and load and all kinds of specific heats and that. We have software that does it, usually not very good, but it does it. And so one of the things that you had to put in there after that was, how much time do you have to do all this, right? If you can put it in there and come back in 3 days, no problem. You can get away with 2 tons. If you want it pulled down in 3 hours, then now you're looking at not 2 tons, maybe 6, 8, 10 tons of capacity. So we refer to those as pull down loads. So if you're coming and you're taking in, you know, a product, 1,000 pounds, and it's coming in at, you know, 5 degrees Celsius, so let's say 8 degrees Celsius, and you're going to hold it at 5 degrees Celsius, that's pretty close to a holding load. So over a period of an hour or two, it's going to cool down, and then it's going to sit there and do nothing, and other than the load from your motors, your lights, you know, somebody going in and out, whatever. However, if you had to take that product, that 1,000 pounds, and it's coming in at 75 degrees, let's say 23 degrees Celsius, and you had to pull it down to, you know, 5 degrees Celsius, and you had to do that in 90 minutes, you're going to have to take that refrigeration system out, and you're probably going to have to put one 3 or 4 times as big in. That is a pull down load as opposed to a storage load. Two completely mm-hmm. different things. Your fridge at home is designed for storage load. So when you put something in, like a case of beer that weighs enough to, you know, make you get to use effort to pick it up, and you have to cool that down.
Yeah.
Your fridge hasn't got the capacity for that. It's going to take forever for it to do. So you either do as you say, put in a few bottles at a time, or you load it up and you don't look at it again for, you know, the next
24
day.
Hours at
yeah,
least.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. You know, that's kind of what we're looking at when it comes to that. So from the case of your freezing situation where you had to take this product that they had in there and you had to freeze it or have a change of state of some kind, you know, your latent heat effusion plus your sensible temperature pull down on it, two different loads, that could be a massive load compared to what that is. I mean, they may be looking at a pull down load when really their size, just a regular walk-in box, is size for holding that product. I mean, yeah, you can put 2,000 pounds of product in there and hold it at that temperature, but you're not going to be able to change the temperature too much. So pull down loads are, generally speaking, fall into blast freezer category. So we've heard of blast freezers where it's like the in-your-face industrial process where you have, you know, a pie come in. And that pie has to be frozen relatively quick, because the quicker you freeze it, the smaller the ice crystals are. Now remember, ice crystals mm-hmm. break cell structure up. So you want very, very, very small cell structure. You want very, very small crystals. So you freeze it as fast as possible. So it might freeze in 15, 20 minutes, maybe half an hour. It is massively, massively overpowered for the amount of weight that's going through it, But what requires all that horsepower, you know, ridiculous amounts of capacity, is the short time frame you have to cool it or to freeze it. So that is a process freezer, which is on the other end of it. The only way you're going to get anything quicker is if you sprayed like liquid nitrogen on it or something like that. So that's the high end stuff. But you're not going to use that power to store the pie. You could probably store thousands of pies at that kind of capacity. But you know what I'm saying? When it comes to freezing quickly for that process, think of McDonald's and their frozen patties. Now, there's an industrial refrigeration process, if I ever saw one, where they're literally, you know, freezing thousands of tons of meat on a weekly basis, and they're doing it very, very rapidly. So something along those lines.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so I don't know where we were before that, but I do want to ask you about discharge temperature as a form of troubleshooting, like a walk-in freezer or a walk-in cooler. Because, I mean, we come across these little reach-ins that don't have any service taps on them. Like I've serviced tons of them. And I mean, the most you do with these things are clean the evaporator, clean the drain, or clean the condenser. It's usually,
but you don't put a piercing valve on there that, you know, leaks the refrigerant charge every 8 months.
Yeah. If I have to put one on, cause I have to do in-depth stuff,
yeah,
that's rarely a thing. So what I've done in the past is taken a discharge line temperature, because it's very easy to get to the discharge line on a lot of these, cause it's right off the compressor. And I would take a baseline of it. And then if it was increased, like let's say I come back 3 months later and it's increased by 20 degrees. Well, why is it increased 20 degrees? Go look at the condenser. Yeah, the condenser's dirty. Let's clean it. And then I check it again and now it's back to normal.
Yeah, you have to look at your compression ratio between your low side and your high side, the amount of superheat you have, you know, was the suction line insulated? It's not before. Things like that, you know. In fact, it can be almost counterintuitive where you can have a frosted up evaporator driving your evaporator temperature way down. You don't have enough refrigerant coming back to the compressor to cool it because your TXV's throttle closed, but it's still a hot day outside, so your condensing temperature's through the roof. Damn straight, man, your discharge temperature is going to go up. This is where everybody's software that they have is a really good tool. Go ahead.
Sorry.
You're going to say...
It was one of my kids I was saying.
Oh, they're going to come in there. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So what you can do in a lot of these softwares, like our Cool Selector 2 and things like that, you can put in the refrigerant, you can put in your, you know, evaporator saturated temperature, your condensing temperature, and then you can put the amount of superheat you have. And it will tell you a range or an approximate value of what your discharge temperature should be. And so what that means is that we are looking for a maximum amount of discharge temperature. Generally speaking, 250 degrees, I start to get a little bit concerned. It depends on the application, but, and this is a good one, you're starting to see more scroll compressors in refrigeration, all right? And, you know, there's good and bad things about scroll compressors in refrigeration. The bad thing about a scroll compressor in refrigeration is that the top bearing, the one that's the furthest away from the oil, is also directly on the opposite side of the scroll discharge. So what happens when you burn out a scroll compressor in air conditioning? You may think to yourself, well, how do you burn out a scroll compressor in air conditioning, right? You got a 45 degree evaporator temperature, got gobs of refrigerant coming back to the compressor to cool it. Even if you've got poor airflow in your condenser, you still got this massive refrigerant coming back cooling the motor.
Hey guys, don't forget that we've got a promo code here at True Tech Tools. It is KNOWITALL. One word, KNOWITALL. That will save you 8% on your purchases at True Tech Tools.
Well, what burns out air conditioning compressors is loss of charge. So it's these slow leaks. I mean, this is turning into a sales pitch for a Micron vacuum gauge. This is really what it comes down to. But your slow leaks that may take 8 months to a year to leak out enough charge. So let's say you have a system that takes 5 pounds, the compressor's dead, you weigh your charge when you reclaim the refrigerant, and it's 3 pounds. Well, that tells you there's a problem. That's a good shot. That's probably a pretty good reason for what burned that compressor out in the first place. Because if you don't have enough gas coming back to cool that scroll, what happens is it goes through the motor, right? You have high superheat, low evaporator temperature, and then you have that bearing up here. And the gas goes into the compressor, it gets compressed and it goes out. So the opposite of that discharge is where that bearing is. When you get to about 250 degrees, you lose all the viscosity of your oil. In other words, you no longer have enough force there, enough viscosity to keep the metal parts from rubbing each other. So now you start to get friction heating, you start to get a runaway effect. Now, the next part of that, the more extreme part, is when you get around 280 degrees discharge. Now your oil breaks down. It's no longer a lubricant, it's charcoal that's depositing on the side of things. Usually two things will happen. You'll either short the compressor out, or you'll seize that bearing. And if you seize the bearing in a scroll, all heck breaks loose, because the scroll starts to rotate instead of orbit. It screws together, and then bang, it just flies into pieces.
Okay, so what I – sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I didn't know you were almost done there. I wanted to throw in that the numbers that you're saying, 250 and 280, that is checking the discharge line itself, right?
Usually about 7-8 inches away from the compressor.
Yeah, but internally it's a lot hotter than that.
It can be. But yeah, there's enough mass flow through there that the temperature drop isn't too much, but that's kind of what you want to look for. The only time I've ever really seen scary or discharge temperatures, and they were kind of what we expected, was when they replaced 502. This is back in the 90s. And people went to R22, and they tried to do low-temp refrigeration with R22. And so you had these semi-hermetic compressors, and you had a fan on the oil cooler. You had a fan on the head. It looked like a drone, like it was going to fly away. And what they're really trying to do is manage this, because R22, because of the shape of the curve, gives you really, really high discharge temperatures once your compression ratio gets to a certain point. In other words, your evaporator temperature drops below a certain amount. It's a terrible refrigerant. But now we get stuck with 448A and 449A, which are kind of the same thing. They're not really good low temp refrigerants. Luckily, they're not going to be around very long, because they're going to get, you know, kicked out the door because of the new refrigerants. But as it stands right now, they're fantastic medium temp refrigerants. But once you get down to minus 10, and help you if you got a ice cream freezer at minus 20 evaporator temperature, unless you keep your superheat minimal. In other words, you know, you're almost drawing saturated vapor out of your suction line accumulator. Your discharge temperatures are going to be very high enough to actually burn your skin when you touch the discharge.
Yeah. Interesting. So what are the ways we can keep our discharge? Because high discharge, we're going to break down oil. We're going to kill compressors. Mm-hmm. So what are the ways we can keep our discharge line at bay?
Okay.
Keep it the way where it should be.
First thing, you know, if you want to do troubleshooting, is basically, I always say, you know, your eyes, ears, nose, whatever, touch. Is a visual inspection when you get there. You got an outdoor unit. What's it look like? Does it look like somebody beat the crap out of it? Are the fins all rotted away? Is there a hedge growing around it so it looks like a giant chia pet? You can't even see it. You know, I've seen all of these things. I've seen sticks stuck in the condenser fan before because, you know, the kids were playing out there and they shoved it in there thinking it'd be funny. Okay, kids do that, right? These are the kinds of things that your eyes will pick up, right? The other thing that you really want to be aware of is if the system is running and you're there doing tests, take a look at your evaporator, okay? Obviously, this is another topic altogether, but airflow, right? If your airflow checks out, you know, you've got something reasonable close to what it's supposed to be, depending on the conditions. Look at your evaporator. Is it, is the pressure, saturation temperature, the evaporator, the pressure, is it where it's supposed to be? Is it too high or too low? In air conditioning and even in refrigeration, the lower your evaporator temperature, the hotter the discharge is going to be on your compressor because of that compression ratio. You can't get away from it. So what you really want to look out for is, you can go measure the temperature leaving the discharge on your compressor. That's fine. But now you got to figure out what's causing it. So if it's a relatively cool day, you know, or it's not hot out, even if it's, you know, 30 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Celsius, and, you know, your condensing temperature is 110 degrees, there's really no reason for your discharge temperature to be above 200, 210 degrees. If it's substantially above that, this is where you need to find out. So this, again, is where you use your eyes and all these kinds of things, where what's the deal with the evaporator? Do you have enough refrigerant in there to make sure that you're not starving the compressor? Do you have enough heat rejection in your condenser? Is there anything there that could be causing issues? Is the system overcharged? If you've got a, you know, 30 degree temperature difference between the air and the refrigerant and the condenser, that's a pretty inefficient condenser. You probably want to find out why. Like, that's going way back to the old, you know, SEER 8 units from like 40 years ago kind of thing.
You know what's funny? People still use that rule of thumb and still preach it on social media nowadays.
Well,
that old rule of thumb. Yeah.
You know, the easiest way to contradict that is pretty straightforward. If you get a charging chart, you know, using subcooling, and you get one for a SEER 13 unit and you get one for a SEER 16, 17 unit, pick an outdoor temperature, you know, 90 degrees for the heck of it, and pick an indoor wet bulb temperature, let's say 67. You compare the pressure that you're supposed to charge the low efficiency unit at, it's going to be about 20, 25 PSI higher than the pressure you're charged to the high efficiency unit. And your subcooling is going to be, you know, 10 degrees in the inefficient one, and it's going to be 7 degrees of subcooling in your high efficiency one, because that gigantic condenser is there for one reason, and that's to bring the refrigerant temperature closer to the air temperature so your compressor doesn't have to work as hard. Yeah. But it gives you less subcooling because, you know, your approach temperatures are closer, but that's where the efficiency comes from. So there is no rule of thumb to charge in these units. I mean, that's a lot of pressure difference. You take a unit and charge it so it's 20, 25 pounds above what it's supposed to be, that's a lot of extra energy that's going to be burning.
Yeah. For sure. And when you said, so this is a real life scenario, and I was in a server room, and one of the compressors, or two compressors were in the machine, both were running, but the evaporator was frozen up on one of the circuits. And I was in my video, I feel that the top of one, I go, that feels pretty good. I feel the top of the other one, and it's scorching hot. Mm. And I remember the comments, some people were saying, well, yeah, that one's the scorching hot is probably way overcharged. I'm like, no, I said, that's the one that's freezing up because it's undercharged because we don't have enough refrigerant in the compressor and the evaporator coming back to cool it off. So the top of the compressor was smoking hot. And when I shut them off and figured it out, yep, it was the one that was short of charge where the compressor was smoking hot. And it was, man, it probably had 50 to 60% of its charge gone from a leak. Yeah. Right. So, and that's the way it was running.
Yeah. By the way, when you're using a micron gauge, just to throw it in there again,
yep.
If you guys want to know the difference between a leak and having moisture in your system, is when you put a micron gauge on, if you have a leak, the evacuation, the vacuum level is going to go up, up, and up until you hit, you know, atmospheric pressure eventually.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have moisture in the system, what's going to happen is the pressure in the system is going to rise and then it's going to plateau. And the value that it plateaus on depends on the temperature that the system is at. Because really what you're doing when you evacuate to dehydrate is you're lowering the pressure in the system low enough so the water starts to boil at whatever temperature it happens to be. So if you're lucky to live down in Phoenix, Arizona, where it's 105 degrees, your evacuation levels required to get rid of moisture are not nearly as tough to reach as, say, here, where let's say it's 3 degrees Celsius. Right. And so now you got to pull the water down, the pressure inside the system down to a low enough pressure that water at that temperature starts to evaporate. So when you stop the evacuation, the water continues to boil and it rises until the pressure in there is the same as the saturation pressure and the water stops boiling. And that's how you know you have moisture. Now, it is really, really hard to get moisture out of POE oil through evacuation alone. But water is your number one enemy in a POE system because you can't produce acid with POE oil and HFC refrigerants unless you have water. So it was actually from, I was at a university training hall, 399 up in Chicago. And the boards, we had these training boards and they had been left open. And somebody didn't shut the little access ports on them and they sat there all summer open. So when we went to start them, they had moisture in them. And so the first thing I had the guys do was evacuate them. Well, none of these we could get down where we could draw the vacuum because there were small systems. But as soon as you turned it off, the pressure went right back up again. And so we had them check for leaks and there was nothing there. And then I just remember somebody telling me a while ago that your best friend in those situations is always dry nitrogen. You bleed dry nitrogen through the system for a while. And because the nitrogen is so dry, it is very efficient at picking up moisture, water vapor out of the oil much quicker than you can with normal just evacuation. And so we did that and we noticed an immediate difference in improvement. So we broke the vacuum with nitrogen. We bled it through for a little bit. We tried it again. It was better. And then after a couple of times, bang, we were there. And we had those vacuum pumps on there for at least an hour beforehand, and we didn't see any improvement because it was just so saturated. So for those guys that are out there that are fighting this kind of thing, if you get into a situation where it's just a miserable experience trying to dry it, get some dry nitrogen, bleed it through, because it will really reduce your evacuation time substantially.
Yeah, I'm gonna say something here to this. So I've had to get into debates with people where they're installing like a resi system, mm-hmm. where it's sealed, like the oil and the refrigerant are sealed, and they're only pulling a vacuum on the lines in the evaporator, but yet they're still doing a triple evacuation. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, you don't really need to do that if you get your evacuation down and it holds under 500 microns, because mm-hmm. we're not battling our POE oil that's mm-hmm. absorbed any moisture yet. It's still in the system.
You're really getting non-condensables and any moisture that may be on the surface in there out of there. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's, I see zero point in doing a triple evacuation on a brand new system. Yet if the system's been in operation for a while, I've had a lot of cases where I'm trying to pull a vacuum down, and I get down, but like you said, on the decay test, when you shut when you isolate your pump from your system and you got your micron gauge on the system side, you start to rise. Mm-hmm. Now I have done this where I've broke it with nitrogen a few times and you see a noticeable difference afterwards, mm-hmm. Where it actually comes down quicker to where you had it before, and it gets down a little bit lower. Then it kind of stabilizes there, and then you break it with nitrogen again. It gets down quicker, stabilizes a little bit lower. And I've done that 3 or 4 times on this one. I actually have a YouTube video of me doing this on a, I think okay. I was talking about it in the YouTube video. I can maybe send it to you. Mm-hmm. It was a chiller. It was like over 100 tons or something like that. And I had to do it on there to get it down to where.
That's where your core removal tool comes in handy, and your 3/8 inch vacuum rated hoses on those big systems.
For sure. That's where I used True Blue hoses. They're 3/4 inch thick, and they're made out of like a plastic. Stainless steel fittings and all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. So anyway, I have seen what you're talking about. I have seen it make a difference in the right circumstance, but I really don't see any point on brand new pipes and a brand new evaporator that you're just opening up for the first time on a new install.
Yeah. I mean, you want to spend your time where it's necessary. You don't want to give people an excuse just to ignore it all the time. If there's no indication, or, you know, if you're pretty sure that it's fine, you know, go ahead. Your gauge is going to tell you after you're done anyways, whether it's mm-hmm. dry or not. Right. So that's the main thing. And again, not to harp on micron gauges, but, you know, since Appian, I think, made that big push back in the day with Dave, and he was talking about how to, you know, increase, you know, your evacuation efficiency and things like that. They're really your best friend nowadays, because, you know, if you're going to do this, at least get the evacuation down to where it needs to be, right? I mean, if it's bad news, then face the bad news and fix it, right? Because if you're using a set of manifold gauges, it's impossible to measure 29.45 inches of, you know, vacuum or whatever it happens to be, right? It's just going to show mm-hmm. 30 all the time. So it's probably one of those things I do recommend, and get yourself a core removal tool, because you will save yourself so much time on evacuation with a core removal tool. It's a big deal. So,
yeah. So let me get your thought on this. So we're talking about refrigeration side troubleshooting, mm-hmm. and in order to troubleshoot refrigeration side issues, we need some sort of gauge on the system. Now I made a statement and I want to get your take on this. Now, what I see online and the techs that I talk to on the daily basis, a lot of them, they like the probes. They reach for the probes because they're small, they're compact, that they can throw them in their tool bag. The industry is starting to put a hate on to manifolds because of the hoses, because it's not good to pull an evacuation through them, because the charging hoses are not necessarily meant for an evacuation. There's restrictions, there's leak points in them. Okay. And now throwing a set of manifold gauges on every system you go to, now you could be introducing contaminants, you could be pulling out refrigerant. So a lot of techs that I know that are progressive are staying with their probes, and you can actually attach fittings to your probes mm-hmm. that you can pull a vacuum, you can recover, you can, where you wouldn't be pulling a vacuum with your probes, but you can recover and you can charge just by adding a T that you can put a hose mm-hmm. onto from your tank. Now, I made the statement that manifold gauges in 10 years will be near extinct. And what I meant by that is they're not going to be, they'll still be hanging out in the guy's van, but they're not going to be used as much, and they're not going to be sold as much, because mm-hmm. the push is on for probes and less use of hoses in this industry, from what I can see.
Well, I mean, I can't disagree with that. I mean, the hoses are your weak spot in your system, right? They're one of the weak links in the chain. You know, you got to make sure you replace the little seals in them. You know, you got to make sure that, you know, the length is critical. If you have long hoses, you have to understand the impact that's going to have on the system charge. When you're dealing with small commercial refrigeration systems that have small refrigerant charges and you have these long hoses, you are absolutely going to affect the refrigerant charge on that system. And if it's critically charged and you take refrigerant out of it, the first time it happens, it might not be enough to really throw it off, but it will eventually affect that over the long term. Non-condensables, I've done it myself where I've been working away and you forget to bleed the bloody hose before you put it on because you're busy. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I just did that. Right. And once it goes in, it's too late. Right now you got to get it out of there. So, you know, a probe, other than aside from the ease of use, you know, of having something, especially if it's got a Bluetooth capability where you can read pressures and temperatures and you're not crawling all over the place, they're fantastic for doing system performance analysis, 100%, right? But again, I think what I always like doing with the manifold gauges is it's an easy way to get in there, get a quick read on something if you have to get it, and then, you know, decide what steps to take from there. You know, a lot of people will say, hey, you know, you don't even need to get the pressure. As long as you, you know the temperature of, you know, the refrigerant after your metering device compared to, you know, your superheat or your refrigeration temperature, that's all you need. You can tell your performance from that. Yeah, you can, right? That's certainly a way to do it. But again, maybe I'm old school. I just love to put a manifold gauge hose on something, get my pressures, and then I can work from there. It's just, I guess I'm old school that way. And that's what I've always done. For years, I've done you know.
No, and that's part of my point, is that the old school traditions of the trade, they're still in force to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not taking anything away from that. I am just seeing what's happening with, if you go to like a school, a trade school, and you talk to a kid that's keeping up with the times of the industry, and you ask him what he wants to use, an old school analog set of manifolds or probes, and everything is on his phone that they're on all day anyway. Which one are they going to pick?
100%.
Okay.
And I can't
blame them. They're going to, you know. Yeah, and they're going to want to pick the probes. Mm-hmm. So as they start coming into the trade and the older generation moves out 10, 15 years from now, where do you think the manifold is going to have a very, very small place?
Yeah, I would agree. Well, the manifold history is not as long as you think. It's not like manifold gauges were around in the 1930s. From what I understand, they were something that was developed, you know, in the relative past. That was a useful tool for technicians to get in and get out, get both pressure on the low and high side, compare them, do things like that, get a quick read on the system. And in doing that, they're fantastic. But then they seem to move into a one tool does all, where I'm going to draw a vacuum on this and I'm going to look on my gauge and I'm going to see if it's, you know, enough of a vacuum to make sure the system is dry, or, you know, over a period of time, I don't have a leak change. Well, they'll find a leak if it's big enough. But when you're talking leaks that leak out over the year to where you end up a year later and you've lost most of your charge, yeah, your manifold gauge, unless you leave it on there for 3 weeks, probably isn't going to show that. So they definitely have their uses, but I think going forward, you can get a lot better information and, you know, probably a lot easier, you know, effort in life by going to these probes, right? Especially if you need to get readings from different parts of the system. Back in the day, you had a helper who would say, what value do you have here? What value do you have here? You'd make a few changes, then they'd feedback. Now you can get all the points of information, say, on your phone or on your tablet. It's a pretty handy thing, man. I don't think I would have been upset if they'd had them back in the day for me. So, you know, I can leave it at that. But I just remember when we were doing supermarket systems and that, you know, we'd have such long hoses on the manifold gauges to reach your way up. You probably held friggin' a pound of refrigerant and the hoses. It's like, whoops. But again, these are really big systems. So what are you going to say?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've had to, and this has sucked for me, but if I'm working on like a heat pump that's 15 feet in the air and a ceiling or something like that, and I got to charge it, well, I have to use a long ass charging hose, like a 30-foot charging hose, because I'm not bringing my tank up into the ceiling with me.
No. So as long as you got the shut-off valves on it, you're fine. I mean, that's,
yeah. So yeah. I have to fill that whole 30-foot charging hose with refrigerant in order to charge this heat pump that's in the ceiling.
Heck, man.
And where does and then once it's charged, everything that's left in that hose, it's a waste.
Yep. What are you gonna do with it?
It's what am I gonna do with it?
Unless you can reclaim it.
Yeah. But, so anyway.
Yeah.
One last thing I wanted to ask you before I take off is nitrogen, like pressure testing with nitrogen. What are your thoughts on the way nitrogen may swing? Because back in the day, I was always told, hey, it's inert. It doesn't change temperature or doesn't change pressure with temperature. And then I always just regurgitated that. I just trusted. But then I came to understand inert just means non-reactive. Mm-hmm. And then I came to understand there's pressure temperature relationships for everything, even nitrogen. Mm-hmm. And then one day I experienced it on a roof and I'm like, wait a minute, I got a leak. And then the next day I go up to the roof, or sorry, later on in the afternoon, I go up to the roof and the sun's out again, the pressure's back where it started. I'm like, wait a minute, now I don't have a leak. The outdoor temperature affected my pressure in the system. What are your thoughts on
this? Well, the easiest way to demonstrate that is to take a balloon, blow it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And since the atmospheric air is what, like 70% nitrogen, take that balloon from inside your house and put it outside on a winter day and watch what happens. Ooch, right?
It shrinks.
Right. So yes, there's definitely a change. You don't get a phase change, right? Because we all be dead.
Yeah, no phase change. That takes a massive amount of
But it is definitely going to change. Now, if you've got a small system sitting inside and it goes from, 23 degrees to 24 degrees Celsius or down to 22, okay. Over a period of a few hours or whatever, you're not really going to see a big change. However, if you have a system that's exposed to the outside and there's a massive change in temperature on that part, you are definitely going to change the rest of the system if it's open to it. And so you need to kind of be aware of that. Off the top of my head, I got to be honest with you, I don't know what the temperature change is with nitrogen. I am sure it's somewhere written down if you want to Google it. But because I can guarantee you somebody probably went into detail on a forum somewhere about it. But
there's calculators. There's calculators that you can.
Okay.
You can either. There's one calculator. If you Google nitrogen calculator, there's one that pops up right away, and it's not hard to use. It's not like you have to scroll. You hit the link and you can put in your starting pressure, your starting temp, and your ending temp, and it will spit out what the pressure should be.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. For me, pressure testing with nitrogen, you're always looking for, to me, you're always going around and testing with the water soap, a solution or soap solution, and looking for changes here and there. It's kind of neat how you can somehow catch a leak with positive pressure and you miss it with negative pressure. I don't know what it is, but it's always good to have kind of both of them. It seems to defy the laws of physics, but I've witnessed it a couple of sides myself, and it's just kind of funny how you miss it. Now, mind you, again, let's go back. I was using manifold gauges, right, and missed the leak with them, but caught it with the positive pressure test. So, go figure. If I had a micron gauge, I wouldn't have missed it, right? So,
yeah, and that's the other thing too with the micron gauge. If they're the technology now, if you do have a leak and your micron gauge is picking it up.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really go around with soap and find it, but we have ultrasonic leak detectors now where it will hear it sucking the air in from the outside.
That's neat.
Which is another cool way to go about finding a leak.
That's like futuristic stuff right there.
But it's now, it's present, man.
It's now.
Anyway,
it's been fun. I appreciate it.
I got to go on a service call. So Jamie,
it's a miserable day out. Where is it?
It's not too far.
Oh, okay.
It's a heating call inside.
Oh, okay.
Doesn't sound like it'll be too difficult. Sounds like the customer has done most of the troubleshooting. They're like, yeah, the blower's running. The induced draft motor comes on, the glow coil thingy I think that's what they said. The glow coil thingy lights up.
You can't miss that.
But there's no ignition. So they've kind of given me sort of most of the troubleshooting already.
Because everything sounds like it's working, but it ain't getting gas, right? Or enough. Well,
that's the first thing I asked them. I said, because they're on propane. I said, is your propane tank full? And they said, yes. So we might be looking at a gas valve, dirty burners. Yeah. Some of these furnaces that I've worked on, they've got a pressure switch that's tied in series with the gas valve that sometimes gets a little moisture inside of it and it sticks open. Right. So mm-hmm. It could be that too. Who knows? We'll find out.
Oh man. When you talk about those hot surface igniters, like the ceramic ones, I got one of those one time from a, what was it? Anyways, I bought this thing, got there, went to get it out and I dropped it. And it broke into like five pieces, right? It was like,
yeah, they're very fragile.
You're kidding me, man. It's fragile as heck. So back I go again to get another one, grumbling the whole way there. Oh, well, what are you going to do?
Life in the trade.
Yeah.
All right, Jamie, thank you very much, man.
Take care. Thank you. Take care okay. And good luck.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Follow HVAC Know-It-All on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and anywhere else Gary feels like popping up. This has been a Two Smokes and a Coffee production.